walk-in closet contained every model of Yeezy, the Kanye West designed sneaker that sold for thousands on eBay in size 13. I love going shopping, he said. He owned 15 different fedoras. When Correa first toured the apartment, the real estate agent pointed out that it had a view of Minute Maid Park from each of its floor-to-ceiling windows, and then added strangely that if Correa saw that the park was engulfed in flames, he would know not to go in that day. The agent's sales technique was almost perfectly misguided, though Correa rented the place anyway. I wake up every single day, look over there, and I'm like, let's get to work, he said. Correa's schedule was almost always the same when the Astros were at home. He arose at 11. He watched something on the enormous TV that dominated his living room. The Walking Dead, The Blacklist, Sons of Anarchy, Prison Break, anything starring Kevin Hart, and drove his white BMW to the ballpark, where he spent the next 10 to 12 hours. He was asleep by 2 a.m. He still declined to indulge in any sort of nightlife. No girlfriends, just baseball, he said. And he did not understand why virtually every day at least one person pointed out to him that he could not yet legally buy a beer. Never drank a beer before, he said. I've had wine and champagne, but never a beer. I don't think that will happen. I don't know why people look forward to that. For many 20-year-olds, a statement like that might come off as judgmental, if not insincere. But from Correa, it simply seemed straightforward. That was the quality Luno and Enos Cabell sensed in him, one Bill James admitted he couldn't detect or measure. Prodigies like Correa were often prima donnas, undermining the clubs they are supposed to help, due to their behavior and their older teammates' resentment of it. But that was not a risk with him. He was mature, but not an automaton. During his first big league spring training, in 2014, his teammates prepared a special locker for him, a laundry basket with an overturned bucket for a seat. He used it happily. Early the next season, when Correa was still in AAA, Jose Altuve wrote Correa's name on a piece of athletic tape, and affixed the phone nameplate over the empty locker next to his. I wanted him here, said Altuve. I was saving his locker. Lance McCullers also reached the majors that year. His call came 3 weeks before Correa's, and he pitched to a 3.22 ERA and on average struck out more than one batter in each of his 125 and two-thirds innings. McCullers has got to be in that 95th to 99th percentile as well, Luno said. Behind McCullers at shortstop, Correa played with Altuve to his left and another player who wasn't much taller than Altuve to his right, Jed Lowry, who shifted from short to third base to make room for his new teammate. The talent is so easy to see, said Lowry, who watched from close range as Correa torqued his body to pull off jump throws like Jeter and hit home runs like A-Rod. That might have been true now, but just 2.5 years earlier, only the Astros were equipped to identify it for what it was. Correa and the Astros finished the 2015 regular season with a record of 86-76, a 35-win improvement in the span of just 2 years. They won their first playoff game in a decade as Dallas Keuchel conjured 6 shutout innings to lead them to a 3-0 wild-card round victory over the Yankees. That event occasioned Correa's first taste of beer amid the celebration in the visitors' clubhouse at Yankee Stadium. His review in full? It tastes bad. In the next round, the Astros blew a 2-1 lead in the best-of-5 American League Division Series to an opponent that was not only finally good, but cohesive and relentless in a way that was hard to explain. The opponent was the Royals, Carlos Beltran's old team, who were on their way to winning their first World Series in 3 decades. A month later, with the Astros' shortstop position now filled for the next 6 years at minimum, Luno traded Jed Lowry to the A's again. The next season, the Astros regressed. They started 2016 cold, and by May 22nd, they were 17-28, and already 10 games behind in the AL West. It was too much ground to make up. They ended up winning 2 fewer games than in 2015, going 84-78, and missed a wild card spot. Maybe, after the outlier that was 2015, they had simply returned to the normalized improvement curve Luno and Sig had once imagined. But perhaps, Luno speculated, their clubhouse was missing something crucial in both seasons. They had turned the club around by ridding its roster of expensive veterans and focusing on acquiring and developing the right young players. but that meant they had almost no veterans. None of their key performers was yet 30 years old. Several, like Correa and McCullers, weren't close to 25. We had some veterans in there, but they weren't necessarily the type of guys that create followership, Luna said. Luna reflected on the 2015 ALDS and the intangible dynamic the experienced Royals had, one that his precocious Astros lacked. Perhaps the club was missing a player who could not only hit home runs, but who had experienced virtually everything a player could in professional baseball. One who knew what it was like to be very young and very old, to make the league's minimum salary and more than almost anyone, to make all-star games, to win awards, to win playoff series and lose them, to play like Superman and to be too injured to play at all for months at a time during a few seasons. A player who had faced 1,498 different pitchers in his career and shared a dugout with nearly 700 different teammates. Perhaps it was missing Carlos Beltran. The analytics community's view of the impact of a team's chemistry on its bottom line performance had evolved in the 25 years since Bill James had sprayed his acid, as he had put it, at Sparky Anderson for continuing to play Enos Cabell almost every day. In 2002, Theo Epstein's Red Sox hired James as an advisor, and baseball's consummate outsider received his first regular access to the inner workings of a club. Something that he had once not been sure was ideal for a cold-eyed analyst who sought to avoid cognitive biases at all costs. By 2010, he'd had 8 years of exposure to the rigors of the player's workplace, filled with highly competitive people who spent most of their waking hours together for as many as 8 months a year, with few days off. Whether you sell insurance or you're a school teacher, obviously the people you work with can make you more productive or less productive, James told the Seattle Times. Baseball would be quite a remarkable activity if it was the one place in the world where your coworkers didn't have any impact on how productive you were. James had less patience than ever for the argument that while chemistry might exist, it was so difficult for anyone to measure that it was best to ignore it. If you divide the world into shit that you know and shit that you don't know, and you study the stuff that you know, then you're not going to learn very much, he said. Luna and Sig had spent their careers in baseball trying to devise ways to turn the shit they didn't know into shit they did. By the winter before the 2017 season, the value of team chemistry remained in the first bucket. Most hardcore analysts, the type who attend wonky if increasingly star-studded events such as the annual MIT Sloan Sports Analytics Conference, no longer scoffed at the concept as simply a result and not an independent cause of winning or losing. It was no longer enough to witheringly conclude that good teams always had good chemistry and bad teams had bad chemistry, but that bad teams were never bad despite good chemistry. But it remained difficult to prove, let alone to assign a weight to its impact. At 2017's Sloan Conference held in March, three analysts tried. A professor from Indiana University's Kelly School of Business and two economists from the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago presented a paper called In Search of David Ross, which found that the concept of chemistry as something that could cause a club to consistently outperform the individual contributions of its players was real. There was a reason why the voluble, relentlessly positive Ross, a backup catcher, had appeared on two different World Series champion teams, the Red Sox and the Cubs, in the span of 4 years. It was not his .229 career batting average. The equation-heavy 43-page study calculated a 20% variation in team wins from what might be expected if victories were simply a result of the sum of a club's players' performances, and further asserted that 44% of that difference could be accounted for by chemistry, which the study's authors called the David Ross effect. Players such as David Ross are true diamonds in the rough, according to our analysis, with their full impact on team performance likely to fly under the radar according to traditional performance metrics, the authors wrote. The paper was not definitive, more a valuable entry into an area of study that remained in its infancy. It focused its analysis on interactions between players on the diamond, not those in the dugout or the clubhouse, which could potentially be even more important. The industry remained a long way from developing a metric to measure the positive impact of someone like David Ross on a club's results, A chemistry wins above replacement, or chem war, perhaps. One of Jeff Luno's strengths was that despite the data-driven approach that had led to the Astros' turnaround, he realized that only a fool would ignore the potential value of the shit he didn't know, the shit for which his data couldn't account. Just because you can't quantify it doesn't mean it doesn't exist, he said. For Sig, the idea of paying a lot of money for something he agreed was real but couldn't value, funds that could otherwise be spent on qualities that he definitely could assess, made him a bit squeamish, if he was being honest. What was chemistry anyway? Was it how players got along, how they shared information to attain a common goal, how they rooted for one another? Was having experienced players always beneficial, or might there be such a thing as too much experience held by players who pushed outmoded ideas on their younger teammates? Might it be better if players didn't get along perfectly to drive healthy internecine competition? And while it certainly seemed like good chemistry mattered and provided a team like the 2015 Royals with an edge, was that an availability heuristic? Not only did Sig have zero predictive information related to chemistry, but he didn't even know what he might try to predict. How could you try to reach a goal if you couldn't define its parameters? But Luno made the decisions. If Luno sought simply a short-term deal for a player who could reliably hit 25 homers from the Astros' open DH slot, the free agent market presented several options. There was 32-year-old Mitch Moreland and 34-year-old Brandon Moss, each of whom might have signed for around $6 million. For a few million more, Luno could have had 31-year-old Michael Saunders or 36-year-old Mike Napoli. Months before the 2017 Sloan Conference, with all those possibilities still available, Luno had already winnowed his list of candidates for the Astros' open DH slot to two free agents. One was Matt Holliday, who had hit 295 homers in his career and whose leadership and willingness to mentor younger players Luno had witnessed firsthand during the three seasons they overlapped in St. Louis. Holliday was to turn 38 in January. The second candidate was even older. On December 5th, 2016, the Astros signed Carlos Beltran. Luno gave him a one-year deal worth $16 million, committing to compensate him more in 2017 than anyone else on an opening day payroll that had nearly quintupled in just 4 years to $124 million, thanks to other measured forays into the free agent market for veterans like the outfielder Josh Reddick and the pitcher Charlie Morton. Beltran, in turn, would receive more than just $16 million. He would, he believed, get a real chance, perhaps his last one, to experience one of the only things he hadn't during his 19 years in the majors and his 3.5 decades playing baseball, a World Series victory. The Royals picked Beltran in the second round of the 1995 draft, not long after he turned 18. He found that his pursuit of improvement was often as lonely as it had been on the empty field in Manatee, Puerto Rico, where he had spent his boyhood tossing balls to himself and dreaming of becoming Roberto Clemente. He asked veteran players for tips any chance he could. Sometimes they even gave them to him. One who did was a fellow Puerto Rican switch hitter named Luis Alicea, who joined the Royals in 2001 when he was 35 and Beltran was 24. 2 seasons earlier, Beltran had been the American League Rookie of the Year, batting .293 with 22 home runs, 108 RBIs, and 27 steals. But he slumped the next year, hitting .247 with 7 homers in 98 games and losing the center field job. Alicea didn't have Beltran's gifts, but he knew how to maximize those he did possess. That was how someone who stood 5'9" and never hit more than 6 homers in a season lasted 13 years in the majors. It was one thing to try to keep a single swing in working order, Alicea told Beltran. Switch hitters like them had to keep track of two, one from the right, one from the left. They had to work more than twice as hard as everyone else. On-field batting practice sessions before games were not enough. Meet me in the cage, Alicea said. There, the two players hit a total of 320 balls, 80 from the right and 80 from the left for each of them. This is something we're going to do every day, Alicea told Beltran. Get to the ballpark early. Okay, Beltran said. We'll do it. Beltran played 152 games in center field that season. He hit .306 with 24 homers and 101 RBIs. Beltran became obsessed with his swing, with maintaining and perfecting two sets of mechanics, and he began spending long hours in the Royals' video room watching his at-bats for any sign of a flaw, any inefficiency. Soon his eyes drifted to the pitchers. He began to realize that after watching them enough times, he was able to pick up on any tendency they might have that he could exploit. He became particularly adept at discerning if they tipped their pitches, meaning if they did anything different before they threw one type of pitch as opposed to another, or before they targeted one part of the plate as opposed to another. He'd reveal his findings to his skeptical older teammates. "Guys, you see what he's doing?" he'd tell them. "No, no, I don't want to know," they usually replied. "It's too quick to do anything about it anyway." It wasn't too quick for Beltran. One day, Beltran was studying video of a pitcher whom the Royals faced often, as he also played in the American League Central, Bartolo Colon of the Cleveland Indians. It was long before Colon began his endless baseball second life as a lovable, portly junk baller nicknamed Big Sexy. Back then, he was an annual Cy Young contender whose fastball reached 100 miles per hour. Beltran thought he saw something interesting. He rewound the screeching VHS tape and pressed play. There it was again. He rewound. Yes, there it was again. Pitchers were creatures of habit, and Beltran saw that Colon had developed a bad one. When he was about to throw a breaking ball, he hurried through his pitching motion. When he planned to throw his blazing fastball, however, he took his time, as if to be sure that he gathered every ounce of might he could possibly put into it. Even 100-mile-per-hour heat was hittable if you knew it was coming. Beltran knew, every time. Beltran made 15 plate appearances against Colon in 2001. He reached base on more than half of them, and he hit 3 homers and 2 doubles, for a batting average of .462 and an on-base plus slugging percentage of 1.841. Almost every pitcher, he thought, had a tell. And if a pitcher had a tell, he could find it, and thanks to the work he put into his swing, take advantage of it. Beltran made a promise to himself. When he was a veteran, no young teammate would have to seek him out to mine him for his knowledge about how to prepare, and no young teammate would be left to his own devices to figure out how to attack pitchers. He would always make himself available if someone wanted his help. "The weight of my living," he thought, "will be to use my time to try to do things for the people that are coming after me." He also thought that he'd be doing something for himself, fostering a team that had a better chance of winning. Beltran knew how intimidating it could be for younger players to approach older ones, even those with whom they shared a clubhouse for 8 months a year. In July 2007, at the All-Star Game, he found himself in the same locker room as the veteran whose record of 8 home runs in a single postseason he had tied 3 years earlier, and whose brain he had always wanted to pick most. While Beltran was by then well-established, an All-Star for the fourth time, 42-year-old Barry Bonds of the San Francisco Giants was about to make his 14th All-Star appearance. Bonds was weeks away from passing Hank Aaron to become the all-time home run king, but he had earned a reputation for something besides his hitting genius and his alleged use of steroids, his orneriness. The game was to be played in Bonds' home stadium, AT&T Park, and in the home clubhouse, Bonds had an entire corner to himself, which contained both a reclining massage chair and a hulking slugger. Beltran steeled himself and asked the glowering Bonds when he might have time to discuss the art of hitting. Bonds' face brightened. He pointed toward the batting cage. "Okay, Carlos," he said. "Let's go." In the cage, Bonds showed Beltran how he liked to set the pitching machine to top speed, more than 90 miles per hour, and then gradually move closer and closer to it, training himself to react to pitches that arrived quicker than any human could throw them from a mound. Even more useful to Beltran was the way he described his mentality. "Sometimes you're in an 0-for-10 slump, and you might start to doubt your ability," Bond said. "But you have to understand that every time you walk to the plate, The person who is in trouble isn't you. It's the pitcher. A decade later, when Beltran arrived for his first spring training with the Astros in February 2017, he knew that he appeared to his young teammates as Bonds once had to him. He was at least 7 years older than almost all of them, earned 30 times more than some of them, and was by then a 9-time All-Star who had hit 421 home runs. During his first days with the Astros, he approached each one of them, not just the other outfielders, and not just the budding stars like Altuve and Correa and Springer, but everyone, pitchers included. "My friend, I am here to help you," he said. "Even if it looks like I'm busy, you won't bother me. If you sit down next to me and ask me a question, I would be more than happy to give you the time that you need." By 2017, the Astros' young players had a world of tools at their disposal that Beltran hadn't had when he sat alone rewinding tapes of the future Big Sexy. The club's video room hummed with computers loaded with clips that could reveal pitchers' tendencies to the percentile. A given night's starter might throw a first-pitch fastball 75% of the time, and 85% of those first-pitch fastballs came in on the inner half of the plate. It was useful information, particularly as pitchers, on average, threw much harder than they had when Beltran was young. Hitters who walked to the plate without a plan of attack, who intended to simply react to what the pitchers threw them, no longer had a chance. But the analytical information didn't capture the other side of hitting, the one that Bonds had stressed. Analytics people, they understand the statistics, the matchups, the percentages, and analytics are now a big part of the game of baseball, Beltran said. But they don't understand what the player is thinking. What is causing his launch angle to be what it is? What is going through the player's mind that is causing him to hesitate instead of being aggressive? Further, what beyond the data could give a player the confidence to believe that every time he stepped to the plate, it was the pitcher who was in trouble, not him? And what could someone like Beltran detect in a pitcher's habits that could equip a teammate to understand not just what the probabilities suggested the pitcher would likely throw, but to know for certain? Beltran's impact was impossible for the Nerd Cave to quantify, but Carlos Correa attempted to attach a number to it. 7. Of the 24 home runs he hit in 2017, by the end of the regular season, Correa attributed precisely 7 to Beltran's influence, to Beltran's showing him how to use video to break down opposing pitchers to a depth Correa had never before imagined, to his identifying their tells. "Maybe they're doing something with their glove that allows you to figure out if it's a fastball or a curveball," Correa said. "The biggest thing I've learned from him is to look at the bigger picture. It's not only about playing defense and catching the ball and throwing the ball and hitting it. It's way more than that. He showed me how to prepare the right way every single day to be successful out there." Proper preparation, it turned out, meant more than watching a Kevin Hart flick, picking the right fedora and the right pair of Yeezys, and heading to the ballpark. During games, between the at-bats Beltran regularly received as the Astros' designated hitter, he spent much of his time in the clubhouse consuming video of not just the opposing pitcher, and not just of his own swings, but of his teammates' plate appearances as well. If they had developed a bad habit, he saw it and let them know, with visual evidence. If George Springer started swinging too hard again, Beltran told him. "I could be pulling off the ball, I could not be following through," said Springer, who, like Correa, would set a career high in homers, 34, under Beltran's tutelage. Couldn't a hitting coach earning a sliver of Beltran's salary do the same thing? "You always just think a coach doesn't know what he's talking about as a player," Springer said. "He's a player." Beltran aided the Astros pitchers as well. In 2016, the season after Dallas Keuchel broke out to win both the Cy Young Award and Houston's wild card game, his performance had disintegrated along with his team's. His ERA jumped by more than 2 runs, from 2.48 to 4.55. His walk rate spiked and his strikeout rate dropped. The first time Beltran met Keuchel in spring training, he gently suggested one reason why. "Sometimes you held your hand above your glove last year before a pitch," Beltran told Keuchel. "If the ball showed, it was a fastball. If it didn't, it was an off-speed pitch." "I appreciate you telling me that," Keuchel said. Keuchel threw 7 shutout innings against the Mariners on opening day. By the end of July, his ERA remained below 2. Hed Beltran, in reality, accounted for just a fraction of the 40% boost in production that Correa attributed to him, not just for the young shortstop, but for all the Astros he mentored, even the pitchers, then he would have been worth far more than the $16 million the club paid him. After 19 years in the big leagues, Beltran knew that he might help Houston win in other ways, too. One night in 2009, an academic named Kate Bezrukova found herself watching a Yomiuri Giants baseball game in the Tokyo Dome, alongside a colleague named Chester Spell. Bezrukova was an assistant professor in the psychology department of Santa Clara University, and she and Spell were in Japan to attend an annual conference hosted by the International Association for Conflict Management. Bezrukova, who stands 5'10", had always loved both watching and participating in sports, and she was excited to see how the Japanese played baseball. To her surprise, not all the players were Japanese. Most were, but others were Korean, American, Venezuelan, and even Australian. And yet they still combined to form a successful team. That year, the Giants would go on to win their record 21st Japan Series. Born in Siberia and raised in Crimea, Bezrukova, whose given first name is Yekaterina, had all sorts of friends as a child. Russian, Ukrainian, Tartar, Jewish. After she earned her doctorate in social and organizational psychology from Moscow State University in 1999, she moved to the United States to continue her studies as a postdoctoral researcher at Wharton, where she worked alongside academics from China and New Zealand and all over the globe. Her intellectual interests began to align perfectly with her personal experience. Why, she wondered, did some diverse groups get along well while others clashed? Why did some international teams of academics collaborate productively while others didn't? In the Tokyo Dome, Bezrukova and Spell realized they had happened upon the ideal type of organization to study how demographic differences, called fault lines, could affect performance. In a lab, it was difficult to measure performance and even to define its parameters. But baseball teams provided not only demographically diverse groups to analyze, but externally valid results, most of all wins. This is a brilliant situation for us, Bezrukova told Spell. Let's get our students on the project. Bezrukova and Spell directed their research assistants to perform fault line analysis on the demographics of all 30 major league teams between the 2004 and 2008 seasons. Those rosters revealed several different potential fault lines that could divide a team into rigid factions called in-groups and out-groups and hinder its performance. They could run between position groups, not just pitchers and hitters, but starters and relievers and everyday players and reserves. They might be based on status, pitting older and better compensated subgroups against younger, underpaid blocks. And they could result from nationality, which could divide a clubhouse along fault lines of culture and particularly language. Such divisions could shift a team's focus from its ultimate goal, winning, to what the researchers called task-irrelevant cues, like competition and distrust between isolated subgroups, as well as restricted communication of information and advice. Bezrukova and Spell estimated that a major league team's fault lines could account for 3 extra wins or 3 extra losses in a given season. A 6-win swing could mean the difference between a club that won a World Series and one that didn't even make the playoffs. Intriguingly, the teams that performed best in Bezrukova and Spell's fault line analysis were not those who were the most demographically similar, mostly young, low-wage Hispanics, say, or older, highly compensated Americans. They were instead those that had players who could cross-cut between a mix of subgroups, who could facilitate a complementarity as opposed to a rivalry, based on their differences. Perhaps they had a player who was older and American, but made relatively little money because he was a reserve catcher, like David Ross. Or perhaps they had someone who was older and highly paid, but also Hispanic, and was particularly motivated to, in academic parlance, deactivate his club's fault lines. Although Beltran's formal education lasted only through Manatee's Fernando Callejo High School, he soon became an unwitting expert in the effects of fault lines. When the Royals drafted him in 1995, he spoke not a word of English. His post-game interviews could have been among those that caused a young Carlos Correa to cringe at their awkwardness, had Correa been old enough then to even watch baseball. Beltran became known for standing at the back of the line during outfield drills. The problem wasn't that he couldn't do what his coaches asked. He could stay behind the ball and use his body's momentum to power his throws to the infield better than anyone. The problem was that he couldn't understand the specifics of the coach's instructions. He copied his teammates' motions, devoting most of the energy he ought to have directed toward improving to simply trying to figure out what he was supposed to be doing. Though he bonded with the organization's other Spanish-speaking minor leaguers, like the Dominican infielder Carlos Feblis, he spent most of his time feeling stressed and isolated. In 52 games in rookie ball in 1995, Beltran didn't hit a single home run. Beltran knew that most of his teammates thought he was odd, a loner, and probably unintelligent by the way they steered clear of him. One day, he was approached by a fellow outfielder named Ricky Pitts. "Hola, mi hermano," Pitts said to him. "Cómo estás?" Besides their position and height, 6'1", Pitts had little in common with Beltran. As a 34th round pick in 1994, he was not a top prospect, and he came from Seattle. But he had a natural inclination to connect with his teammates, whoever they were. While Pitts figured his career in baseball was likely to be short, he wanted to emerge from it with skills that would help him in the future, such as a mastery of Spanish. The teenagers made a promise to each other. Wherever the years to come were to take them, to Lansing and Spokane and Wilmington, they would help one another learn each other's language, a few words a day. "Say it however it comes out," Pitts told Beltran. "If you say something crazy, I won't laugh at you." By 1998, Beltran had reached Kansas City, while Pitts was forever stuck in single A. If Beltran could by then follow only half of what his first big league manager, Tony Muser, said in his pregame addresses, he could at least haltingly communicate with teammates other than Feblis, like Johnny Damon and Mike Sweeney. During games, he often found himself distracted by his fear of what would happen in the clubhouse afterward, how he would stumblingly try to answer the questions reporters asked him. But he was on his way to full fluency, to the point where he no longer felt isolated and would soon muster the courage to introduce himself in English to a famously grumpy slugger and talk hitting with him. Ricky Pitts had given him the key. 16 years later, Spanish-speaking players comprised a quarter of the league, but many of them still had to rely on the kindness of teammates like Pitts. When Beltran joined the Yankees in 2014, the club had three Japanese players, the pitchers Hiroki Kuroda and Masahiro Tanaka, as well as Ichiro. Each had his own personal translator provided by the team. And yet the Yankees' spring training roster had five times as many Latin players, three-quarters of whom could speak no English. After team meetings, they would all rush over to Beltran to find out what Joe Girardi, the Yankees manager, had said. Beltran, then 37, began lobbying the league and the players' union to require each club to hire a full-time Spanish translator. 2 years later, thanks largely to his efforts, they did. Still, when you walked into any big league locker room during any given club's downtime, you almost always found two groups hanging out, separate from each other. The English speakers and the Spanish speakers. There might as well have been a jagged fracture running down the middle of the clubhouse's low pile carpet. Beltran thought there had to be a better way. In Houston, Beltran wanted to create not only an environment in which useful information could freely flow between players, but also the type of inclusive, unified culture that he had longed for when he was young. Basically, he wanted the clubhouse to be fun. He focused much of his effort on mending the natural division between its American and Latin inhabitants. The Astros' opening day roster included 17 Americans and 7 Latinos. While many of the club's native Spanish speakers, including Altuve, Correa, and the utility man Marwin Gonzalez, had become bilingual at younger ages than Beltran had, in previous seasons they tended to stick together and speak in their natural tongue, while the Americans did the same. When an American player asked him a question, though, Beltran intentionally often answered in Spanish before repeating his reply in English. He wanted to normalize both languages. He quickly realized he had a 23-year-old ally. Alex Bregman, the LSU shortstop whom the Astros selected with the 2015 compensatory pick they received due to their failure to sign Brady Aiken the year before, sailed through the minors even faster than the Astros had hoped. His rise from Quad Cities to Houston took just 13 months, even though it had included the learning of a new position, third base, as shortstop belonged to Correa. Minor league pitching proved no match for someone with his skills and fearlessness. Neither did a language barrier. Altuve and Correa had to laugh as Bregman incessantly chattered at them in what he professed was nearly perfect Spanish, a subject in which he swore he'd received straight A's in high school in New Mexico. It wasn't close to perfect, but they appreciated the effort and admired the way he never had any qualms about giving amusingly butchered post-game interviews to Spanish language TV stations. "I'm speaking Spanish 50% of the day," Bregman said. "I want to be able to connect with guys from all different backgrounds. I think that's what leaders do." Beltran noticed that Bregman spent a great deal of his time communicating, or trying to, with one teammate in particular. Though he was 32, Yuli Gurriel had lived in the United States for less than a year. He defected from Cuba in 2016, a shock to that nation, as he was not only one of the Baseball Mad Island's greatest players, but belonged to one of its leading baseball families. The Astros signed him to a 5-year, $47.5 million contract, which contributed to their skyrocketing payroll. Gurriel arrived knowing virtually nothing about his new country's culture or customs, and spoke no English at all. He was exactly the type of player who could become isolated and resentful in an American clubhouse. Bregman refused to let that happen to his first baseman. The two yammered at each other in Spanglish all day long. Bregman, Beltran realized, was Gurriel's Ricky Pitts. Beltran could have taken the lead in helping Gurriel himself, but he knew it was better for the club's dynamic for someone like Bregman, younger, a fellow infielder, American, to do it. "Keep it up," Beltran told Bregman. "Imagine how you make Yuli feel, to know he has a friend who is trying to comprehend him." "When Beltran came over, that merged the clubhouse, really," said Bregman. "This year, we're all just way closer." Beltran instituted other bonding strategies. He never understood why even the very good teams he had been on tended to treat regular season wins as a matter of course. Most of the time, after cursory handshakes and fist bumps, players would shower, dress, and go their separate ways mere minutes after they'd recorded the final out. It was, he thought, a missed opportunity. During spring training, he had enlisted the president of the World Boxing Organization, a friend, to commission two championship belts for him. After Keuchel pitched the Astros to a 3-0 win over the Mariners on opening day, Beltran explained to his new teammates what they were going to do with those belts. After each victory, before anyone hit the showers, every member of the team would sit at his locker for the awarding of the belts, one to the hitter of the game and one to the pitcher of the game. Beltran would distribute them that night, but thereafter the belt holders from the previous victory would decide who got them. Each new awardee had to give credit to the other players who had performed well that game before beginning his own acceptance speech. Failure to participate would result in a $500 fine from the club's kangaroo court, over which, of course, Beltran presided. The first night, a couple of players had watched the proceedings from the entrance to the shower room, with towels already around their waists. That was $500. "Baseball players, when you mess with their money, they listen," Beltran said. Nobody was fined after that. Soon the players acquired a new clubhouse sound system to blast music during the ceremonies, and whirling party lights. When reporters entered the clubhouse, as they were permitted to do after the ceremonies had concluded, they sometimes had trouble making out the faces of the players they were trying to interview. That was because of the fog machine. One day in mid-July, Beltran arrived at Minute Maid Park to find a curious message scrawled on the clubhouse's whiteboard. "Funeral for Carlos Beltran's glove, 3:30, it read. Though Beltran still did fine in the outfield, and StatCast indicated that he got to precisely the percentage of balls he should have, it had been 2 months since he had played anything but designated hitter. He walked onto the field at the appointed time to find the rest of the Astros solemnly kneeling in a semicircle in the outfield, around a box that contained the leather implement that had once won him 3 straight Gold Glove awards. Brian McCann, the Astros catcher, stood in a priest's billowing robes next to three faux tombstones, ready to deliver the eulogy. Beltran couldn't stop laughing. He whipped out his phone to record the ceremony. It was funny, but also something more. It was one thing for him to try to build what he believed to be a winning culture by sharing the knowledge he'd accumulated, demolishing demographic walls, and buying a few boxing belts. But for his teammates to collectively concoct a way to tease him like this, someone who was far older and richer and more accomplished than any of them were, that was chemistry. Everything he had tried to do was working. No one would ever have dared to hold a funeral for the glove of Barry Bonds. During the summer of 2017, Beltran experienced something he never had before, not in Manatee, not even when he had felt so stressed and lonely in the Royals minor leagues. Jessica, his wife of 17 years, and their children, two daughters and a toddler son, had moved into his place in Houston after the girls finished their year at a private school in Manhattan. The previously quiet rented house vibrated with energy and laughter. Then 2:15 p.m. approached, time for Beltran to head to the ballpark. For the first time in his life, he didn't want to go. He didn't even tell Jessica at first, and nobody with the Astros sensed that anything had changed. He prepared just as hard as always, and probably harder. "You don't walk into the clubhouse and see him there checking his phone," Luno said. "He's on the video, he's into the game, he's watching. That's something the other players would look at. This is a Hall of Famer. He's toward the end of his career, and he's still working to get better every day." He oversaw the club's belt ceremonies as enthusiastically as ever. There were many more of them than anyone could have anticipated. By the end of July, the Astros had a dozen more wins than any other club in the American League, 69 of them, against just 36 losses. They were a juggernaut, leading the majors in runs scored, on pace to accomplish the virtually unthinkable offensive feat of hitting more homers than any other team in baseball, while recording the fewest strikeouts. Nobody knew precisely how much credit Beltran deserved for that, but everyone was certain it was a lot. Secretly, Beltran's reluctance to head into work became a daily phenomenon. He finally admitted it to Jessica. "I think this year is it for me," he said. His body felt good. In the cage, the club's hitting coach, Dave Hudgens, could diagnose no mechanical issue. "Man, your swing, your bat speed, it's there," Hudgens told him. And Beltran usually knew exactly how an opposing pitcher would try to attack him. But although the Astros had few regrets about giving him that $16 million, because of all the intangible and often unclassifiable ways he helped the club, the individual results he produced on the field did not match his salary. His exit velocity dropped by nearly 2.5 miles per hour from the season before, to 87.5, below average. By July's end, with more than half the season over, his on-base plus slugging percentage had declined by 145 points from 2016 to 705, and he had hit just 12 home runs. It appeared as if Carlos Beltran had finally gotten old. Beltran knew the issue was deeper than that. Analysts could detect and parse launch angles and velocities, but they couldn't know what inside a player contributed to those numbers. Beltran did. In August, as Jessica and the kids prepared to go back to New York for school, Beltran's slump deepened. That month, he batted .210 with two home runs in 26 games. The Astros, who had spent most of the season looking like the World Series favorite, declined with him, going 11-17 in August. Suddenly, they were the Disastros again. Some of it had to do with injuries, which piled up as the summer wore on. Correa tore a ligament in his left thumb while taking a swing in July, putting him on the bench until September. Soon, the Astros' disabled list required scrolling. It included nearly a third of their roster, Springer, McCullers, both their catchers, McCann and Evan Gattis, and three relievers, Michael Feliz, Will Harris, and Tony Sipp. After a July in which they scored more than 7 runs a game, in August they averaged just 4. No one slid face-first into a rival's posterior, but it was a genuine malaise. As the month neared its end, a once-promising season, the one for which Jeff Luno, Sig Meidel, Mike Elias, and Jim Crane had spent 6 years assiduously building, was falling apart. Even Beltran's steadying influence seemed unlikely to save it. Luna believed that a clubhouse with good chemistry could persevere through periods of failure better than one without, and Kate Bezrukova and Chester Spell's research independently confirmed that concept. Deactivated fault lines could prevent poor results from snowballing. Even so, as August approached, Luno knew he had to do something even more drastic for someone with his worldview than paying for a quality he couldn't quantify. Chapter 8. 2 Seconds to Spare. The Houston of 2017 was no hinterland jerkwater. It had become the roaring international metropolis of which Roy Hofhinz had always dreamed. In 1960, when the judge was busy conceiving the Astrodome, Houston's population had been 1 million and relatively homogeneous, 74% white, 20% African-American, and 6% Latino. Now it had more than doubled in size to 2.3 million, and it was the most diverse city in the United States. 38% white, 36% Latino, 17% African-American, and 9% Asian. Its citizens spoke some 145 different languages, and more kept arriving. By 2030, Houston was expected to pass Chicago to become the country's third largest city. Hofhinz would have loved it. More customers. More green. Hofhinz himself might have coined Houston's new marketing slogan, "The City with No Limits." The motto mostly referred to its friendliness to free enterprise, one the judge had helped foster. The ideological thrust in Houston in the 20th century has been anti-government, anti-regulation, anti-planning, anti-taxes, anti-anything that seemed to represent, in fact or fantasy, an expansion of the public sector or a limitation on the economic prerogatives and activities of the city's business community, wrote a University of Houston professor in 1989. That philosophy persisted and even broadened. Oil, shipping, and aerospace were joined by information technology, biotech, and finance as thriving industries. Were Houston an independent nation, its economy would have been the world's 24th richest. The 2017 Fortune 500 included 18 Houston-based companies, fed by its continually booming population. They were headquartered in soaring office towers that regularly reshaped the downtown skyline. Houston had 37 skyscrapers taller than 150 meters, or 492 feet, the 29th most of any city in the world, tied with Abu Dhabi, Moscow, and Mumbai. Two more were under construction. Houston grew not just up, but out. There were no geographical barriers to stop its sprawl, just flat coastal plain, and, unusually for a major city, no zoning laws to hinder it. The city covered 350 square miles in 1960, but by 2017 it had annexed enough adjacent communities to expand to 655 square miles, enough land to fit all of Baltimore, Chicago, Detroit, and Philadelphia within it. You could get in your car at Houston's southwestern border, point it northeast, set your cruise control to 60, and remain in Houston an hour later. All that unfettered expansion, driven by the city's entrepreneurial spirit, had required the concreting over of wetlands, such as those on which the judge had once built the Astrodome. Most of Houston sits on a clay-heavy soil called black gumbo, which experts consider one of the least absorbent soil types. When it rained, especially heavily, the water had nowhere to go. Neither did the people, the majority of whom, as in even the richest of cities, spent the sunniest of days trying to get by. On August 26, 2017, a Saturday, it began raining, and it didn't stop. Dallas Keuchel was thinking about getting in bed early. It was 10:30 p.m. Central Time on August 31, 2017, near the end of a week that had been taxing for him and the Astros, but devastating for many others in Houston. Hours earlier, Keuchel and his teammates had peered down from the portals of the Astros' plane upon the outskirts of a city whose landscape they barely recognized. Where there had once been neighborhoods, there were now wreckage-strewn lakes dotted with rescue boats. Exhausted and finally home, Keuchel sat down to unwind as he usually did late at night, with a video game controller in his hand. Then his phone started to vibrate. Keuchel looked at the screen. "Shit, I'd better answer this," he thought. "It's the big dog." Exactly a month earlier, on July 31st, Keuchel had been furious with the big dog. That was Jim Crane, as well as Jeff Luno and everyone else in the Astros front office. As the non-waiver trade deadline approached, Keuchel watched as his club's rivals loaded up with new aces to bolster their rosters for playoff runs, even though it meant coughing up top prospects to acquire them. The Dodgers traded for Yu Darvish. The Cubs added Jose Quintana. The Yankees got Sonny Gray. The Astros, meanwhile, had secured only Francisco Liriano, a bullpen arm who might be able to get some left-handed hitters out here and there. Disappointment is a little bit of an understatement, Keuchel, the top starter on a first-place team, told reporters. He did so for two reasons. One was that he was being honest. It was how he felt. He and his teammates, particularly Jose Altuve and George Springer, hadn't endured what they'd endured, the butt slide, the losing streaks, only to have management come up one piece short of building a champion. The second was that although the trade deadline had passed, he knew Luno had one more way to add that final piece, and he wanted the general manager to feel the players longing for it. As August progressed, Luno felt it. He figured his scuffling offense would rebound once Correa, Gattis, McCann, and Springer got healthy, but his pitching rotation had fallen apart too, and even the return of McCullers, who was nursing a sore back, wouldn't be enough to rejuvenate it. In August, his starting staff pitched to an ERA of 4.83, a spike of nearly a run per game from the season's first 4 months. Only Colin McHugh registered an ERA of less than 4.20. Keuchel, working his way back from neck discomfort, allowed 20 earned runs in 35 and two-thirds innings for an ERA of 5.05. Mike Fiers, the number five starter, was even worse, yielding 27 in 32 and two-thirds for an ERA of 7.44. If the Astros had any hope of playing deep into the playoffs, the rotation needed the boost. Luno hadn't given it. The month of August, though, offers a reprieve to general managers who missed the trade deadline at the end of July. Players can still change hands with limitations through August 31st and remain eligible for postseason play, making that one of the most important dates on the baseball calendar. Players could be traded in August as long as they had first been placed on revocable waivers, which meant that they and their contracts could be claimed by any of the league's other 29 teams, essentially in reverse order of their win-loss records. Putting a player on revocable waivers carries little risk for the club that employs him. If he is claimed by a rival, the club has three options. It can pull him back and keep him for at least the rest of the season. It can work out a trade for him with the team that claimed him. The third option explains why many highly compensated players pass through waivers entirely, which means that they are free to be traded to anyone until the arrival of September. The club that owns him can decide to simply let him go and put the claiming club on the hook for his exorbitant salary, a significant financial risk. But at the stroke of midnight Eastern time, all those options evaporated. Playoff-bound clubs had no choice but to move forward with who they already had. Even before Luno had emerged from the July trade deadline with only Francisco Liriano, he and the Astros had earned a reputation among baseball's other general managers. "They don't give up anything in deals," one griped. That wasn't exactly true. While Luno had spent his first three summers in Houston as a deadline seller, methodically trading away all his club's veteran assets for prospects, he reversed course when the Astros proved a surprising contender in 2015. That July, he worked out a deal for Cole Hamels, only to see it fall apart when the Phillies ace invoked a clause in his contract that allowed him to block trades to nine teams, including the recently toxic Astros. Hamels ended up with the Rangers. Luno still acquired three major league players, starter Scott Kazmir from the A's and Fiers and center fielder Carlos Gomez from the Brewers, in exchange for a total of six minor leaguers. Those trades hadn't worked out. Despite their new talent, the Astros still washed out of the playoffs that year against the Royals, and all they had to show for it was a half dozen fewer minor leaguers, four of them top 100 prospects. Now, in 2017, they were contending again, yet this time Luno had added only Liriano. He could easily rationalize why. As July's non-waivers trade deadline approached, he'd had conversations with every general manager who might have a pitcher to sell. He had even struck a deal for Zach Britton, the Baltimore Orioles All-Star closer, only to see the Orioles pull the plug at the last moment. It was a letdown, but Luno knew that a subsequent trade made out of emotion, even desperation, would have likely been a bad one. From a valuation perspective, most deadline deals were ill-advised. His goal had always been to build not just a one-time winner, but a sustainable one. Talented prospects who could continually replenish his roster at submarket wages were key to that effort. Sig's algorithms almost always advised against deadline trades, which required the sacrificing of years of cheap production for, sometimes, a couple of months of starts from an expensive and aging pitcher. The reality is that any economic modeling which includes projections is not going to like a deadline deal, where you're trading what could be an enormous amount of future value for a decent amount of present value, Luno said. The question all general managers have to grapple with is, how much of a deficit can you take on one deal? No, the math does not support these types of deals. It's a matter of using your best judgment. Luno's judgment had changed in the month since the non-waiver trade deadline, due to a few developments for which no algorithm could account. His inaction in July demoralized not only Keuchel but the entire clubhouse, which surely combined with the injuries the club sustained, like Carlos Correa's damaged thumb, to lead to its August swoon. By the month's end, the Astros remained a lock to win the American League West and reach the playoffs. They were 80-53, with an 11.5-game lead in the division, but they no longer seemed likely to advance far in an October that had once held so much promise. Things were pretty bleak, Luno said. They were bleaker in the Astros' hometown, which needed any cause for optimism that it could get. Even the all-green Jim Crane was willing to pay for that boost. Hurricane Harvey, with its 130-mile-per-hour winds and 5 feet of rain, had by then slowly swept through Houston, routing more than 30,000 people from their homes and causing what would prove to be $150 billion in damage. While all the Astros players and employees had been miraculously spared Harvey's wrath, as had Minute Maid Park, Crane told Luno that it was the club's duty to do something big, to provide some measure of hope for the now battered city in which he had made his fortune. By 10:30 p.m. Central on August 31st, half an hour before the waiver's trade deadline, Luno had come close. He had agreed to trade for a player who had not only passed through waivers unclaimed due to his enormous salary, but who would represent the season's most significant acquisition, bigger than Jose Quintana or Sonny Gray, bigger than even Yu Darvish. Justin Verlander, the longtime ace of the Detroit Tigers. Darvish, Gray, and Quintana were all frontline starters. Verlander was a future Hall of Famer. That was the first piece of information the big dog passed along when he called Keuchel. The second was that Verlander's contract included a full no-trade clause, meaning that he could not be officially dealt unless he agreed to it. Would Keuchel phone Verlander and convince him of the charms of both the Astros and of Houston? Hell yeah, I will, Keuchel said, before remembering whom he was talking to. Sir? 6 days earlier, on August 25th, Luno had left Houston with his wife Gina and their 3-year-old son Henry to accompany his club on what was supposed to be a quick 3-game road trip to play the Los Angeles Angels in Anaheim. Luno always brought his family on trips to California. Gina grew up on the West Coast, and her parents still live there. As forecasters were predicting Harvey to make landfall in Texas as soon as that evening and churn a course toward Houston, Luno had taken several precautions before he left. He moved his family's furniture to the second story of their house near Rice University and positioned a few webcams so he could remotely monitor his property for potential flooding. Luno and his family stayed with Gina's parents in West Los Angeles, but he intended to return to Houston to hunker down with his front office in order to focus on the final days before the August 31st trade deadline. He knew it might prove the most significant of his 6 years as the Astros' general manager. Luno first talked with Al Avila, the general manager of the Tigers, about Justin Verlander in July, but they hadn't come close to a trade. As the Astros scuffled in August, the 34-year-old Verlander had shaken off a rocky first 4 months and recaptured his old dominance. Over 42 innings, he went 4-1 with a 2.36 ERA and 50 strikeouts. Those numbers came over a small sample size of starts, but might have been almost commensurate with his contract, which called for him to earn $28 million in 2018 and $28 million more in 2019, making him one of the